Welcome to EJB Talks, Rutgers Blaustein School experts in policy, planning, and health, where we talk with our faculty and staff experts, as well as students, about how the fields of public policy, urban planning, public health, health administration, and public and urban informatics affect your lives. Welcome back to EJB Talks. I'm Stuart Shapiro, the Dean of the Blaustein School of Planning and Public Policy, and the purpose of this podcast is to highlight the work my colleagues and our alumni in the fields of policy, planning, and health are doing to make the world a better place. This season, our ninth, we will start by speaking with some of the new faculty that we didn't get to in season 8. We're going to start with the professor who is going to be our concluding episode for season 8, Professor Mark Paul, who teaches in our public policy program and has a new book out, The Ends of Freedom. Welcome to the podcast, Mark.
It's great to be here.
So we will get to the book. I think we'll probably spend quite a bit of time chatting about it. But first, I wanted the audience to get to know you a little bit. And if you could tell me how you became an economist, what's the dark story there, and how you became interested in environmental policy in particular?
You know, ever since I was 4, I wanted to be an economist. No, I kid.
I was going to say, you'd be the only one who could say that.
You know, I don't know any kids in elementary school that stood up and said, I want to be an economist. I grew up on DiGiorno pizza and bagel bites and not necessarily the best food. And thanks to public broadcasting, Julia Child instilled a passion for French food in me. And when I was about 14, 15, I started working in kitchens. And it was my time working in kitchens that got me interested both in economics and in the climate crisis that we're all living today. It was working in kitchens alongside immigrants that had been showing up for work 60 hours a week, every week, you know, maybe 1 week a year off for years on end. And they weren't making minimum wage. They were making $10 or $12 an hour. But they were not making enough to live the American dream. They were not making enough to, you know, live in the neighborhoods with high quality schools. They weren't making enough, certainly, to ever bring their partner to eat at the restaurants we were cooking in. And for me as a high school kid, that was my top concern. Could I afford to bring a date to this restaurant that I work in? And the answer was no. No, I couldn't. And it got me interested in inequality. And furthermore, you know, seeing all the food come in and talking to the purveyors got me really fascinated in our food system and thinking about food sustainability, which is, you know, highly dependent on a stable climate, which we just see slipping through our fingertips. And so it was really my time working in kitchens that got me excited about economics and got me really concerned about climate change because, you know, under a changing world, it's really hard to conceptualize how we're going to be able to continue to live high quality, you know, decent lives and eat high quality food when you see, you know, storms inundated farm fields. You know, most farm fields are actually often in flood-prone areas. So this kind of set me on my course. And then there was this small disruption. You might remember the 2008 financial crisis, and that was kind of the nail in the coffin for me. When that happened, I just said, I need to understand this thing we call economics, and I never looked back.
That's great. I have to admit, at the start of your story there, I was very curious as to how you were going to get from Julia Child to economics there. So, but you did a good job. It was a consistent narrative, and as someone who has odds backgrounds himself, I get it, and I hear you. So I do want to talk about climate change for the audience that doesn't know. Mark is a leading voice on climate change and on the Green New Deal. We haven't gotten the Green New Deal out of the Biden administration, but we did get the Inflation Reduction Act. And I want to get your impression of it, what your thoughts are on how far it moves the needle.
I think the Inflation Reduction Act is a monstrous accomplishment. I think often in the climate space, we're all doom and gloom. And it's really important for us to take a step back and give ourselves a pat on the back and really appreciate what a tremendous victory this was. I mean, we are talking about hundreds of billions of dollars in investment to help transition our economy towards a clean and sustainable economy. According to the White House numbers, we're talking about roughly $360 billion in climate spending. According to Goldman Sachs, they're telling us that it looks like we're going to be spending closer to $1.2 trillion from the Inflation Reduction Act. The reason for the discrepancy there, actually, this is pretty interesting, is that most of the tax credits, which mainly is what makes up the Inflation Reduction Act, it's primarily a tax credit bill that gives people tax credits for installing things like solar panels on their house or EV chargers, or for instance, buying an electric vehicle, for that matter. You get a nice tax credit from the government, but those tax credits are uncapped. So we actually don't know how much money the government's going to spend. And both from a macroeconomic perspective and from a climate perspective, I say the more the merrier. So, you know, people ask me, though, you know, is this enough? Is this going to get us there? And the answer is absolutely not. What the Inflation Reduction Act is a crucial down payment on the transition. But that's all it is. It's just a down payment. It is sufficient to hopefully reduce emissions by about 40%. But that's not 100%. And to meet our climate goals, we need to hit 100%. So, you know, after environmentalists take a break and appreciate this victory, it's time to get back to work and think about what complementary policies can work with the Inflation Reduction Act to fully decarbonize our economy.
And 100% by 2050 is the goal, right? If I remember right from at least one of the reports there. It might not be enough. It might not be the goal you want, but I think it's one of the treaty goals.
Correct. So goals vary depending on who you talk to and when. But roughly the goal is to cut emissions in half by 2030 and reach what's called net zero by 2050. So essentially, do not put any more emissions into the atmosphere than we are taking out.
Right. And the next steps, from what I can tell, when there's a front page bold headline in the Times today, is what enters my area, which is regulation. And at least from the Biden administration, I suspect that the rest of the climate emissions are going to be undertaken through the executive branch and through, I mean, they've already done stuff with power and with cars, and now steel and cement is what the article today is talking about.
That's exactly right. You know, the Inflation Reduction Act was mainly carrots, you know, handing out money, but we need sticks too. And that's where regulations come into play. And I am heartened by the Biden administration working both within the purview of the White House and the Environmental Protection Agency and other regulatory agencies to do what they can to rein in emissions. However, you know, I have to be honest, the Biden administration's also made some disappointing choices. For instance, they greenlit the Willow Project, which is a massive fossil fuel project on the North Slope of Alaska. So, you know, it's funny, President Biden says, you know, we have to decarbonize, while at the same time breaking a crucial campaign promise, which was no more drilling. So that has been a bit unfortunate.
We could go on about this for quite a while, but I do want to give you a chance to talk about your book a little bit. And the book is a much broader project than just environmental policy. What prompted you to write it? And I have a feeling you might go back to your origin story in talking about that a little bit.
So, you know, the book came out just in May, a few months ago. It was a tremendous opportunity to take a step back and write a book, to really think comprehensively about what type of economy we want to build and why. So, you know, why did I write a book? We have a lot of books already out there. And when I look on your bookshelf or my bookshelf, I can tell you for sure we have a dozen books about how neoliberalism is failing us, how neoliberalism gave rise to inequality, how neoliberalism is one step away from being dead. But then the question always arises, what comes next? And I think that in general, we lack a coherent narrative for what it is that we're working towards in the economy. Now, once we have come to this realization that, you know, free markets, we're not delivering freedom, we're not delivering the type of liberal democratic values that we thought they would, people today, I think, are grasping for, okay, we get that neoliberalism didn't work, but you know, what next? And in most books out there, they have 10 chapters on how neoliberalism failed and maybe one chapter on what to do next. And it's just a laundry list often. And so I wanted to flip that on its head. I wanted to think about what is an affirmative vision for how we can build an economy to provide high quality lives for everybody. Because I do believe that economic justice and democratic values need to be at the core of our economic paradigm. But I think that, you know, that coherent vision was lacking. So I set out to write about it while grounding it, importantly, in American history and in the American narrative. You know, often you see politicians talking about what countries like Norway and Sweden do. And I think we can learn a lot from our neighbors, you know, be they in South America, Europe, Africa, you name it. But I also think there's a tremendous amount of value to going back to our history and thinking about, you know, did American history have to culminate in neoliberalism? Are there alternative paths? And better yet, how have we thought about, you know, the kind of core narrative of our nation, which I would argue is freedom, that core identity, and what it actually means to us today?
So you used the word narrative, I think, three times there, and I want to pick up on that a little bit, because you take as the jumping off point in your book FDR's second Bill of Rights, and few politicians in history, and I love history, particularly American history, few politicians in history were as good at establishing a narrative as FDR was. So can you talk a little bit about what he was doing and what his goals were and how that ties into what you're talking about?
Sure. So Roosevelt, you know, really is often credited with the creation of what we today call the New Deal. And it's a little funny because for people who don't study history, they think the New Deal was, you know, one or two pieces of legislation that we just passed. Now, the New Deal was well over 100 pieces of legislation passed over a roughly 6 or 7 year period of time. You know, and then retroactively, people look back and call this, you know, huge swath of legislation the New Deal. You know, what I do is I draw on the history of Roosevelt and some of his contemporaries who tried to articulate a vision that the American people could latch onto, but that he could also turn into policy, actionable policy. And so for Roosevelt, you know, kind of his first key messaging was around what he called his four freedoms. Mm-hmm. And this is what he galvanized the American people around to engage in World War II. Those four freedoms were the freedom of speech, the freedom of worship, the freedom from want, and crucially related to the war, the freedom from fear. And as the war started to wind down, as the Allies had victory within their sights, Roosevelt started to turn his attention back to the American people. The, you know, remember, he was elected at the height of the Great Depression. The war did a tremendous amount to pull the American people out of the Great Depression. But people, in particular soldiers and their families, were very concerned that when the war concluded, would they have that freedom from want that Roosevelt had promised them? And so, in fact, Roosevelt put forth in 1944 an economic Bill of Rights, what he also called a second Bill of Rights, to secure that freedom from want for each and every American. The other way he talked about this was to procure people cradle-to-grave security. That if they are born into our community, our nation, that they are entitled to things like the right to a job, the right to a house, the right to an education, the right to a health care, and more. And Roosevelt was quite serious about this. In fact, he called on Congress to enact it as soon as possible. However, for the history buffs in the you know, listening sphere, they'll know that Roosevelt passed away just a year after calling for an economic Bill of Rights. So he never had the time and the power to fully secure it. But the legacy, you know, really continued. In fact, Martin Luther King, I think a crucial fact that we don't talk about, his final essay published after his untimely assassination was entitled "We Need an Economic Bill of Rights." And when King transitioned from focusing on civil rights after the passage of the Civil and Voting Rights Acts, he started focusing on economic rights, arguing, as Roosevelt did, that the right to a vote was insufficient without core economic rights. Indeed, political rights, civil rights, and economic rights all work together to deliver true, meaningful, and enduring freedom.
And these economic rights, they consist of, in your book, you talk about housing, health, education, environment, drawing on your other previous work. Anything else? What else am I missing there? I'm going off the top of my head.
Yeah, the other one that I really cover in the book is basic income and banking services. To make sure that everybody has cash in their pocket to buy basic things like food. You know, somebody asked me, well, why is food not a basic right? And I said, well, it is. I just think that the market's actually decent at delivering food. So if we ensure people have income, in my book, we ensure people have food.
Gotcha. So when FDR was talking about this, we, as you noted, were near the end of World War II. It's hard to think of a time in the past century when the country was more unified, all sort of, you know, pulling together first to fight the Depression and then to fight the Nazis and the Japanese. Now, to say the least, things are a little different in terms of the body politic. And so I guess that here's the question is, how does one sell this idea now, given the challenges, and yes, FDR died and things started to come apart then, but given the challenges then, how do we sell something this big, this broad in the current environment?
You know, that is the trillion-dollar question. And if I had an ace in the hole to answer this, you know, I'd be spending all my time on the Hill getting it done. But unfortunately, that's not where we are right now. You know, look, I don't want to pretend that this is going to be easy. I don't. One of the most important things that we often don't value is the power of a enemy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as you highlighted, you know, both the Nazi enemy and also the communist enemy, I think, created a tremendous amount of space for, you know, both the New Deal and then later on the Great Society and mm-hmm. other key pieces of what we call kind of the welfare state here today. And, you know, right now we're starting to solidify around China as an enemy, which I am deeply, deeply concerned about from a kind of geopolitical stability standpoint and from a kind of anti-war standpoint, but we'll set that aside for the moment. You know, look, we went out and talked to voters, and what's fascinating is these ideas resonate with them. We polled voters across the nation, and what we found is 2/3 of voters support the idea of an economic bill of rights, including the majority of independents and Republicans. So when we actually talk about the American people, the notion that everybody should have the right to a job or the right to a home or the right to healthcare is not a left or right issue. These are ideas that people believe in. Unfortunately, when it comes to Washington, these are highly politicized issues that are often dead on arrival due to partisan gridlock. You know, that said, one thing that I find really encouraging is that particularly amongst young Republicans, these ideas are incredibly popular, with most of the economic rights that we polled amongst young Republicans having support over 70%. And so, you know, we could potentially be optimistic that some generational shifts might give rise to kind of additional groundswell of support for passing some of these ideas. But at the end of the day, I think we need to try to move past partisan conversations, which is why I, in the book, really try to connect these ideas to the long struggle for freedom in America, trying to move beyond traditional Democratic or Republican talking points to notions of what does it mean to be an American? What do we owe each other? And how can we, you know, reconstruct an economy that actually provides true opportunity and some semblance of a quality of outcome as well?
I love ending on an optimistic note. I do want to ask one more question, though, and it's not optimistic or pessimistic. I've always found after writing a book, you're like, oh my God, okay, so now what next? Because I'm sort of starting from scratch again, because I put everything into that book. Maybe I've gotten, you know, a few separate things that come out of it, but it really is time for the next project, next idea. What's next for you?
Yeah, it's such a hard question because I agree with you. When you finish the book, you know, you just it's like having a second child. I had right around the time I finished this book, I also had my first child, and there were some similar emotions. You know, what's next is I've been pivoting quite a bit towards working on what's called supply side fossil fuel policy. Mm-hmm. So there's a tremendous amount of work in the environmental space on demand side policies, which is how do we increase the demand for renewables and decrease mm-hmm. the demand for fossil energy. But there's actually been shockingly little research thinking about the fact that we need to wind down fossil fuel assets. So we need to actually fundamentally reduce supply of fossil assets. And what does that transition look like? And how do we address it from an economic policy standpoint? So that's what I've been working on these past few months and will continue to work on moving forward.
Well, you may come into my regulatory wheelhouse there.
Very much so.
Mark, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been a great conversation.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Also, a big thank you to our new producer, Tamara Swedberg, and to Karen Olson, who helps with production as well. We'll see you next week with another talk from another expert at the Blaustein School. Until then, stay safe.